Hello and welcome to part 10 of my podcast, All About Antarctica. I'm Dr. Steve Emsley, and I'm a professor in the Department of Biology and Marine Biology at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, where I've been teaching an undergraduate class titled Antarctic Ecology, Geology, History, and Policy. In this podcast, I've distilled this class down into numerous parts that cover all these topics about Antarctica. Part 10, presented here, is on penguins and other seabirds. When the topic of penguins is raised, most people tend to think only about Antarctica as their habitat. However, of the 19 living species, only 5 actually occur in Antarctica, and of those, only 2 are endemic there. Most species of penguins occur in the subantarctic, or along the southern coast of South America, Africa, Australia, with one species, the Galapagos penguin, occurring as far north as the equator in the Galapagos Islands. So, their distribution is entirely in the southern hemisphere. The 2 endemic penguins in Antarctica are the emperor and Adélie penguins. The emperor is the largest living species, at little over 1.2 meters, or about 4 feet tall, and the most popularized penguin in movies and books. It is unique among penguins in that it begins breeding in the winter, which is surprising at first because this is the darkest, windiest, and coldest time of year in Antarctica. Why do they do this? Because of their large size, the emperor penguin produces a single large egg, and to survive in Antarctica, the chick must complete some of its development within this egg. This means the egg not only takes a long time for a female to produce, it takes even longer to incubate and raise the chick, so that it can fledge, go to sea, and survive, to become a breeding bird years later. It takes the female 30 days to produce the egg, after which she goes back to sea to recover her energy. The male then incubates the egg, holding it on his feet, as no nests are built by this species. The male also has a brood patch on his lower abdomen, which is a patch of bare skin under the feathers so he can nestle the egg up against his skin for maximum heat transfer. The male is fasting the entire time for this incubation, which lasts another 2 months. Then the female returns to allow the male to recover at sea while she continues to protect the small chick under her body and feed it its first meals of fish and squid. Eventually, the chicks can move about the colony independently and form creches, or groups of chicks that congregate together, allowing both adults to go to sea to forage. By the time the chick is fully grown and is ready to go to sea for the first time, it is summertime in Antarctica, the perfect time for it to find enough food to survive its first year. If the adults had started this breeding cycle in summer, the chick would be fledging in winter, when its chances of survival would be greatly diminished. So, this species has evolved to begin the breeding cycle in the dead of winter, and have been quite successful at doing so. I'm sure you've heard of emperor penguins walking sometimes hundreds of kilometers over sea ice to get to their breeding grounds. This is because in winter, extensive sea ice has already formed around Antarctica, sometimes enough to more than double the size of the continent. Since the edge of this ice will melt first when spring arrives, the penguins must walk to ice close to the continental margin, ensuring a stable platform for their long breeding cycle as the outer edge of ice gradually melts and breaks up. By the time the spring and summer ice breakup reaches the edge of the continent, the chick is ready to fledge and now does not need to walk as far to get to open water. Recent warming trends have been impacting this breeding strategy, though, and some colonies have been lost when the ice breaks up too soon before the chicks are ready to go to sea. Some colonies have adapted and have moved to new locations, but the warming is going to still be a problem in the future, and so just last month, in November 2022, the emperor penguin was listed as threatened by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The other endemic species, the Adélie penguin, is also an ice-adapted species, but unlike the emperor, this penguin has its nesting sites on ice-free land and begins breeding in the Antarctic spring. The Adélie penguin is much smaller than the emperor, with an average height of about 70 centimeters, or 2 to 2.5 feet. It is the enigmatic black-and-white penguin of Antarctica. Unlike the emperor, they begin breeding in the spring as, being smaller, they can produce eggs and raise chicks faster within the short Antarctic summer. They return to the exact same colony and nest site each year and use pebbles from the beach to build a nest bowl that is sturdy and protective of the eggs. The colony, then, consists of a dense concentration of pebble nests and can range in size from a dozen or more individuals to hundreds of thousands of breeding pair. As you can imagine, these larger colonies can be quite noisy. The Adélie penguin lays 2 eggs instead of 1, and the male will fast and incubate them for about 2 weeks while the female recovers her energy at sea. The eggs take about 35 days to hatch, and the chicks need brooding for about a week before they can stand at the nest next to their parents. This guard stage will last up to 3 weeks before the chicks form a creche and both parents can go to sea. The chicks are fed a rich diet of krill and some fish and grow rapidly, molting from the down to true feathers by age 6 to 7 weeks. The chicks go to sea after that and spend the winter at the edge of the sea ice, where up to 50% or more may not survive, depending on how well they were fed and how productive the marine environment was that year, especially with krill. If they do survive, they usually return to the same or nearby colony to breed by the time they are 3 or 4 years old. Because the Delhi penguin is so tightly tied to sea ice and krill productivity, they are considered a biological indicator species for the marine environment and have been monitored closely for decades in Antarctica to see how they respond to changes in climate and sea ice extent. In fact, the Adelie penguin is the most thoroughly studied seabird in the world, and how it responds to climate change can help us determine how to best conserve it and other marine species in Antarctica. The Adelie penguin also has an incredible fossil record in Antarctica, extending back to over 45,000 years, or beyond radiocarbon dating. My research program is primarily based on this record, as it tells us so much about how the species has responded to past episodes of climate change, going back to before our last ice age. This fossil record is very well preserved in the cold Antarctic environment thanks to the ornithogenic soils these birds form that I described in an earlier podcast, which contain an amazing biological archive of tissues and organic remains. I don't believe there's any other seabird in the world that has such a complete record of tissues, including bone, feathers, eggshell, and even intact mummies, skin and all, that have been recovered from the same region where that species lives today. With these ancient tissues, we can complete radiocarbon dating to determine the occupation history of Adelie penguins at specific locations. We can apply stable isotope analyses to estimate diets and shifts in diets, past and present. And we can use ancient DNA to look at evolutionary rates over millennia. All these analyses are possible with the Adelie penguin and provide a tremendous amount of information, beneficial for predicting how this species will respond with ongoing climate warming in Antarctica. We now know, for example, that most of the Adelie penguin colonies in the Ross Sea region, including those that number in the hundreds of thousands, are relatively young in age, formed only within the past 1,000 to 2,000 years. Colonies are constantly forming or being abandoned over time due to ever-changing marine conditions, food availability, and climate change. Further, this research gives us insight on where Adelie penguins are likely to move in the future, based on current warming trends and sea level rise, providing the means to conserve these potential future breeding and foraging locations to ensure the long-term conservation of the species. As an example of how well tissues preserve in the cold, dry climate of the Ross Sea, I'll describe one site I visited and sampled on Beaufort Island in the southern Ross Sea and not too far from the edge of the Ross Ice Shelf. A layer of penguin feathers had been discovered by some botanists working on the island in 1997. When I went to investigate this site in the early 2000s, I found this layer exposed on the side of a terrace with about 20 meters of sediments above it. Wave action over time had exposed this layer, which, given the depth it was at, would not have been found otherwise. The deposit turned out to be several layers of molted feathers of the Adelie penguin and in perfect shape, appearing fresh or modern. There were also some bones and eggshell, so this might have been a former breeding colony in the past. Radiocarbon dating indicated these remains were so old, though, that they were beyond the range of this dating method, or over 45,000 years old. The layers were deposited prior to the last ice age, when open water surrounded Beaufort Island, and before the Ross Ice Shelf began advancing at the start of the ice age at about 27,000 years ago. I suspect these layers are about 60,000 years old, but confirmation is needed with a different dating method. Still, these remains indicate that the southern Ross Sea was inhabited by Adelie penguins during the last interglacial period, and this has been confirmed with the discovery of several relict pockets of ornithogenic soil along the Scott Coast, with dates ranging from over 26,000 to 43,000 years old, indicating the presence of breeding colonies and thus open ocean in the Ross Sea at that time. There are two other penguin species that are common in Antarctica, but mainly in the Antarctic Peninsula, the Gen 2 and Chinstrap penguins. As with the Adelie, with whom they are related in the same genus, Picacellus, or the brush-tailed penguins, they also use pebbles to build nests on ice-free beaches and terraces. They also produce ornithogenic soils, but most that have been sampled are very young in age, less than 2,000 years. However, on King George Island, bones from raised beach deposits indicate they were present there over 7,000 years ago. Gen 2 and Chinstrap penguins are more abundant in the sub-Antarctic, but have been spreading southward down the Antarctic Peninsula in recent decades with the warming trend. Gentoos prefer inshore waters to feed, so disappearing sea ice helps them expand to newly exposed beaches and habitat, while chinstraps prefer open ocean for foraging. All three species coexist, and can even be found in breeding colonies along the same stretch of beach, such as at King George Island. Here, long-term monitoring of all three species has provided a wealth of information on their breeding and foraging behavior, and how coexistence is possible without competing for the same resources. For example, gentoos feed more on fish than the other two species, while adelies and chinstrap prefer krill, though adelies will also take fish and squid. The last and fifth species of penguin to breed in Antarctica is the macaroni penguin, a member of the crested penguin group. It is the largest crested penguin, and the only one to venture into Antarctic waters. Its numbers are very small there, though limited to a few nests and individuals that show up on maritime islands in the Antarctic Peninsula. Only on Elephant Island do they have colonies numbering in the hundreds. It is most abundant in the sub-Antarctic, especially at South Georgia Island, where it numbers in the millions, though in recent years their population there has declined. As with the pygocephalid penguins, the macaroni feeds primarily on krill, but differs in laying two eggs, of which the first is about 60% the size of the second, and rarely produces a viable chick. Why even spend the energy to produce this first small egg if it is never successful? Obviously, natural selection has favored the second egg, and one possible explanation is that the first egg is often lost, more in territorial disputes between males, and observations have confirmed this. Note also that the crested penguins do not build elaborate nests to house their eggs like those of the brush-tailed penguins, so egg loss can occur more easily during disputes among males. There are many other seabirds that disperse to Antarctica for feeding and breeding, and I cannot cover all these species here. I will mention one other endemic species, though, the snow petrel. Petrels are part of a group of true seabirds, also known as tube noses, by the presence of a tube on top of their bill that enhances their olfactory sense at sea. The snow petrel is a small bird, about the size of a pigeon, though sizes vary a great deal, and is pure white in all its plumage. Only its dark bill and eyes offset this white color. These birds forage around pack ice and feed on fish, squid, and krill. They are fantastic to watch at sea, gliding low to the water and turning into the wind. Sometimes you may see hundreds of them roosting on an iceberg. Snow petrels are the most southerly bird in the world and nest on cliffs and nunataks, or rocky promontories surrounded by snow and ice, along the coast of Antarctica and as far inland as several hundred kilometers, where these ice-free nunataks and mountains exist. Like all tube noses, they lay a single egg. There are two subspecies of snow petrel, the greater and lesser, with the larger form found in the Ross Sea area and the smaller in the Antarctic Peninsula and continent. Regardless, when you are traveling south and start seeing these birds, you know you are in Antarctic waters. The last species I want to mention is the South Polar Skua. Related to gulls, this bird has sleek, attractive plumage, ranging from brown to light brown and even a blondish color. They are very intelligent birds, too, and live up to 25 to 30 years. Like many seabirds, skuas mate for life and maintain territories around their nesting area, usually on terraces near the coast, but they also protect foraging grounds if they have a penguin colony they hunt at as well. Most skuas, though, feed at sea on krill, fish, and other prey. Skuas often get a bad reputation in Antarctica because they are such opportunists, stealing eggs and small chicks at penguin colonies or foraging for scraps at research stations. However, they are fearless and are fierce in protecting their nests and chicks from any potential danger. If you walk too close to their territory, you will know it. The birds will start screaming, then launch into the air and dive bomb you. They can hit you on the head pretty hard with their feet. I know this quite well from working with skuas to monitor their nesting success, where I learned to respect them and their fearless nature. I also learned that if you see a skua diving at you, just stare at it, and it will fly above your head and not hit you. Skuas will attack and fight other skuas that wander too close to their territories as well. I've seen skua fights last as long as 15 minutes, until finally breaking up with the losing bird escaping. However, when away from their territories, such as when they gather at a lake or pond of fresh water to drink and bathe, they all stand around together in a relaxed mode, with no conflicts. Skuas, because of all these characters, are one of my favorite birds in the world. Thank you for listening to my podcast, All About Antarctica. I'm Dr. Steve Emsley of the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, and I hope you tune in to Part 11 when I begin a new section on Antarctic history, beginning with the discovery of the continent.